I believe we have counsel present now. Good morning, counsel. This is the case of Elitech Inc. versus Conveyance Consulting Group Inc. We will start by having members of the court introduce themselves, and I will recognize counsel, and we will get started with arguments at that point in time. I'm Mike Havikin. I am the Chief Justice, and by order of seniority on the court, serving on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
Good morning. William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Friedenberg.
Counsel, Mr. Dingwall, are you with us today?
I am. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. I understand you're in San Diego, California.
That is true.
Mr. McKernan, are you with us today?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
Nothing for me.
Nothing for me either.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mr. Dingwall, then, good morning again to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, again, I'm Jeff Dingwall on behalf of appellant Mr. Jonathan Jones and Cross Appellees Conveyance Consulting Group and Jones Consulting Incorporated. For over 2 years, this case was harmoniously litigated at the district court, or I guess at least to the extent that any litigation can be harmonious. But for 2+ years, there were no discovery motions or discovery orders. There was just one amended scheduling order. And otherwise, at the district court level, things moved forward about as swimmingly as could be expected in a civil case. The discovery deadline came and went. The expert deadline came and went. The dispositive deadline came and went, again, with no issues. And the case was coming up upon a date that the scheduling order had set and it'd be ready for trial. So when the district court entered judgment against the defendants as a discovery sanction, it was exceedingly harsh because, again, in 2+ years of litigation, there was no evidence of discovery misconduct. Certainly not any pattern of misconduct that we see in cases in which the sanction of judgment has been upheld. Under Rule 37, sanctions seek to remedy certain circumstances, and those circumstances are one.
Counsel, there was a motion to compel that was sustained by the court. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was that the discovery ordered in that order, sustained the motion to compel? Was that ever provided?
Well, part of the issue of in the order granting the motion to compel is there was nothing set forth specifying what what the defendants were supposed to turn over. The district court simply instructed defendants to provide complete and full responses to discovery that they had already answered 20 months prior. So, I know there was discussion on the record in some of the hearings that plaintiffs or defendants had turned over some additional documentation, but there was nothing in the court's order to specify what exactly was required of defendants.
And you've raised that as an assignment error in your appeal, is that correct?
Correct.
And the plaintiff argues that that's not an appropriate assignment error if there was no objections raised by you at the time the motion compelled was heard. What's your position in regard to that claim?
I think there's a distinction between an objection to the motion itself and an objection to the court's order. And in this case, the objection is to the court's order. And granted, the bigger issue is the entry of judgment as the sanction. Certainly the order on the motion to compel rolls up into that and plays into that substantially. But the issue on the court's order is that there was no specific findings that or the defendants had engaged in any misconduct at all in the discovery process. And I believe that objection and that assignment of error is preserved.
I beg your pardon. How does the withdrawal of counsel factor into our understanding of the appropriate remedy?
As with the motion to compel, I think the issues of withdrawal of counsel sort of created a snowball effect. The motion to compel was brought, again, after all material deadlines had passed, and defendant's counsel then, just 2 weeks prior to the motion to compel being set for hearing, moved to withdraw. Defendant's counsel at that point had represented the parties for more than 2 years throughout the entire litigation. They were in the best position to respond to the motion to compel, and by withdrawing, not only did it leave Mr. Jones representing himself, but it left him unable to proceed on behalf of the corporations because they were at that point unrepresented.
Was there an objection to the motion to withdraw by appellee?
There was no formal objection. The court essentially entertained the motion on its own and did not conduct a hearing, and the withdrawal was granted without consideration of the factors that we've argued should have been considered by the court, including the fact that it came at a very sensitive stage of the litigation and that the defendants were highly prejudiced in the grant of the withdrawal.
But you're not claiming that the clients weren't aware of the motion to withdraw or the court's ruling on the motion to withdraw?
No, there was certainly the motion to withdraw contained a certificate of service showing that the defendants were served. And we know that obviously that the defendants became aware that they did ultimately withdraw. And then, through a course of continuances of hearings and things like that, it was discussed at length.
And you're also not claiming that the clients were unaware of the order compelling discovery or of the motion for sanctions for failing to comply with the order compelling discovery, correct?
No.
A situation where people just didn't know what was going on.
No, I think, unfortunately, at that point in the case, and to answer your question, Your Honor, no, we're not arguing that they were not aware. I think at that portion of the case, unfortunately, things kind of snowballed into a confluence of events that left things very unsettled. And I think the appropriate steps by the district court would have been to preclude the initial counsel from withdrawing until the motion to compel had resolved.
Wouldn't it have been beneficial for the defendants to show up and argue that their counsel shouldn't be allowed to withdraw and explain what was going on so the court had some information? It seems kind of hard to argue the court erred with the court only really hearing from the party moving or the attorneys moving to withdraw. I mean, does that create some of the difficulties for the district court?
I think certainly there could have been more done by the defendants in this case, but again, the district court granted the withdrawal without any hearing, and I don't think it was clear in the withdrawal motion by the initial attorneys, and certainly not by the second attorneys, that they had given reasonable notice to the defendants, particularly under the circumstances of the case, with the motion pending, with all material deadlines in the case passed, and with the case being set for trial just a few months out. And so going back to the matter of the Rule 37 sanctions, in this case, there was no finding by the district court that the defendants had done anything under the three circumstances that Rule 37 sanctions are designed to address. And then beyond that, even if there was to be a sanction imposed, there's factors that are set forth in the Hill case that the district court was to consider in determining what the appropriate sanction should be. In this case, none of those factors were considered or analyzed by the court in its opinion. And moreover, given the nature of the discovery dispute and discovery order, which is simply a matter of providing further discovery responses, I think it's clear that a much more appropriate sanction would have been something along the lines of an evidentiary or factual determination aligned with the information that the plaintiffs were seeking in their motion to compel. And with that, if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, I do have one more question. You said there was no hearing on the motion to withdraw. Is that correct? And how do we know that from our record?
There was no formal record, as I recall, of the of any hearing being held.
It was set for hearing on January 3rd, and the court entered the order of January 4th, allowing the withdrawal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So was there a hearing on January 3rd, and does our record reflect one way or the other?
There's no record that reflects one way or the other, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McKernan, good morning to you.
Good morning and thank you. May it please the court. My name is Brian McKernan and I'm here today on behalf of the Pelley Elitech Inc. The issue before this court today is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in granting Elitech a default judgment and dismissing appellant's counterclaims after providing the appellants with multiple continuances and three express warnings as to what the ramifications would be should the appellants continue to ignore its previous order compelling discovery. As this court's aware, when looking as to whether or not a court abused its discretion in the awarding of a sanction, you have to look at the underlying facts of every case. And Elitech respectfully submits that the underlying facts in this particular matter clearly establish that the court was well within its discretion of doing what it told the appellants it was going to do on multiple occasions, should it continue to not comply. And it did just that. After providing it with multiple opportunities to cure the problems with discovery and continual continuances to the extent they needed to get lawyers or they needed additional time. Respectfully, if the facts of this case justify the sanction that was granted, we question what facts would, especially when you look at the conduct of the appellants and particularly their complete disregard for the court's order or the various schedules. The motion to compel
counsel,
filed.
Counsel, defendants argued that the motion to compel was filed 20 months after the interrogatory's request for production documents were responded to. What's your best argument as to why that has no impact on the motion to compel?
I think simply, Your Honor, is the motion to compel was granted. And to the extent there was an issue with the timing of the motion to compel, or there was an issue with any other parts of that motion to compel, they were provided with numerous opportunities to make them. On a more practical level, the reason that that motion wasn't filed until that point is because they had counsel and we had been working together on discovery. We had done third-party discovery, traveling to New Jersey for depositions, taking depositions of the appellants. And the timing of that coincided with there was an April 22nd, 2019 trial setting. So we filed our motion to compel in November, because the only discovery that had been done by the appellants at that point was written discovery. And we wanted to make sure that there was that we had complete and full responses to that written discovery, because if that's what they were going to rely upon when they went to trial, we wanted to make sure that those were clear and those were properly responded to. So, like I said, the practical answer is if there's an objection, they had plenty of opportunity to raise it, but they didn't. What they did is the court continued the original hearing date on that motion to compel to provide the appellant's opportunity to get additional counsel. We know they're aware of that, and we know they're aware that their counsel was allowed to withdraw because they showed up on January 17th, two of the appellants, and verbally asked for additional time to get counsel. The district court obliged, and they continued that hearing until February 14th. Incredibly, after coming and asking for additional time and being granted that additional time, the appellants didn't bother to show up. They didn't bother to get counsel. They didn't bother to come in and explain all these reasons that we've seen now in their appellate brief for the first time as to problems they had with this particular motion to compel. And so it's been waived. But the egregious conduct or lack of respect for the entire process doesn't stop there. I think it's important to note that at the time the motion was filed and at the time the order was granted, there was an April 22nd trial set that had been set, and the parties were pushing towards actually having a trial on the merits. After the order to compel is granted, and in the order, it gave them 10 days to comply, and it was clear as to what the ramifications would be if they didn't comply, we never got a response. To this date, we haven't gotten a response from them either saying, go pound sand, our discovery responses are correct or complete, or any type of a response from them. So what we did is March 28th, 2019, and again, by this point, we're still looking at an April 22nd trial setting. We had given them close to 45 days after the order to comply or at least contact us or a new lawyer contact us and say, here's what's going on. We didn't get anything. So we filed a motion for sanctions, and we were clear in our request for what we were seeking and the basis of why we were seeking it. Most notably, again, an upcoming trial setting. That hearing was continued on two separate occasions. First, on April 10th, 2019, one of the appellants again showed up and expressed his need for additional time to get a lawyer to help him to respond to the discovery and prepare his case. The court granted him an additional 30 days to go get counsel and come back. 30 days pass, and on May 9th, we show up for that hearing, and at this point, they did get a lawyer that filed a limited appearance. And through the limited appearance, the appellants were able to get the court to grant their continuance on the hearing and give them additional 45 to 60 days. But the record's pretty clear again, notwithstanding the language in the order and notwithstanding the language at the original hearing where the court informed one of the appellants what would happen if they don't comply. This is where the court says, and I'm quoting to the, again, the May 9th, 2019 hearing. And the court says, as you indicated, Mr. Noose, who was the lawyer that was hired by the appellants, default judgment is an extreme remedy, and the court is very reluctant to do that. But given the status of the case, the court would be, I think it would be in its discretion to go ahead and do it. But we'll get another hearing date in 45 to 60 days. And at that time, we are going to go forward with the motion for sanctions, including request for judgment and dismissal. So you know, I'll give you an extra 60 days. That's the time limit, all right? That was out of the express instructions provided to appellants and their counsel the second time they showed up and asked for a continuance on that motion for sanctions. They were given an additional 60 days. 60 days go by, and the only response we get is a formal motion to withdraw the Friday before the July 11th, 2019 rescheduled hearing from that counsel. And that motion's part of the record. And there was a hearing on that motion to withdraw. It's in the record. And the discussions that took place.
Did the defendants appear at that hearing?
The defendants did not appear individually at that hearing. But
had they been given notice of the motion to withdraw?
They had, Your Honor, and if you look at the actual motion and notice of hearing that was filed, it shows that a copy of that was sent via email and via mail to the defendants. And so they did have notice of that hearing. More importantly, Your Honor, I think they had notice of that hearing because back on May 9th, when one of the defendants was sitting in the courtroom, that's when the court expressly told them, here's your deadline, right? Here's your 60 days, and that's it. So they had notice of this, and they had multiple notices of this. And what we're left with come July 11th is now another lawyer that's seeking a dismissal. And the court, after already giving them notice of what would happen if they didn't comply with a court order, mind you, they're in contempt of a court order this entire time. He did what he said he was going to do on three separate occasions. And based on that, we believe this court was well in its discretion to grant that particular order. Respectfully, what else can a court do other than provide these defendants with multiple opportunities to say, okay, you're coming to me. If you truly are bad timing, well, we've continued the trial for you. If you currently are, I think language used in their brief was over a barrel, well, we've removed that barrel now because the trial's gone and we've given you additional time. But the reward or the response is not, hey, we think we've already complied with this, or here's our supplemental discovery responses. It's nothing. As we sit here today, we've never received supplemental discovery responses. We've never received anything formal suggesting that the order was improper, that they didn't know how they could comply, they didn't know what was left or outstanding to comply. None of that. We've gotten zero from them. And it's for that reason that we think the court's order, or the court was well within its discretion when it ruled. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. McKernan. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
1 minute and 21 seconds, Mr. Dingwall.
Thank you. Quickly, Justice Funk, I would like to go back to your question regarding the notice provided to the defendants as to this, Mr. Noose's, the second counsel's, withdrawal. And I would just like to point out that his motion to withdraw was filed just 3 days before the motion for sanctions was set to be heard. And that there is a certificate of service showing that it was served on the defendants, but again, we're talking 3 days before a dispositive motion was to be heard, and the motion to withdraw filed by Mr. Noose did not contain any indication of reasonable notice given to defendants as is required in that circumstance for permissive withdrawal. And so I just wanted to address that quickly. And with the remainder of my time, I would just like to state that to the extent that sanctions were warranted at all in this case, given the issues at stake, which were merely additional responses to written discovery that had been had previously been answered 20 months prior, the proper sanction would have been something along the lines of an evidentiary sanction or a factual determination, as was pointed out in the Hill case, which held that even an evidentiary sanction was too severe when the court had not previously entered or asserted sanctions or lesser sanctions. And with that, I see I'm out of time.
Thank you very much, counsel. That concludes arguments in Olatech versus Conveyance Consulting Group, Inc. Counsel, you are excused, and we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Garrison versus Otto. Thank you.